All right, so let's get started here. First, I wanted to clarify a question that came up last time. So when we were talking about linearizability, I presented this example. And so just to give some context here, there are three processes. They have, each has an assignment followed by a print of the variables from the other two program. And these examples show various interleaving of the statements within the processes. And what is shown here is what is printed by this each of this interleaving. Okay? And this is the signature that is shown. So the question was, what is the signature? And in some cases, the signature is same as what is printed in other, in at least this case, it's different. So what the signature is basically what. So signature of this interleaving says what is printed by P1 followed by what's printed by P2 followed by what's printed by P3 regardless of the interleaving. So when you see a signature, you should know that P1 printed 10, P2 printed 10, P3 printed 11. Okay. What is shown here is what does this interleaving print, and this interleaving can have an arbitrary interleaving of statement. So that's the difference between the signature and the printing. Okay, when P1, P2, P3 go in the same order, sometimes the signature and the print statements will both produce the same thing. Okay, but if P2 goes first for any reason, which is what's happened here, the signature is going to be different because signature says what did P1 print, and P1 is here in the interleave. Okay, what's the definition of signature? So the signature basically says what does the signature of this interleaving says what did P1 print, what did P2 print, and what did P3 print, regardless of the order in which they went. So if you look at the signature, you should say P1 printed 00, P2 printed 10, and P3 printed 11 in this case. Okay, in this case, the interleaving is also P1, P2, P3, which is why this and this match. Okay, in this case, P1 printed 11, P2 printed 01, P3 printed 01. But this is what the interleaving is. So what appeared on the screen was 01. That says that this is P2, this is P3, and this is P1. Okay. They are the processes, the three processes. Okay. Is that clear? That was a question that came up. So, and the same example is in the book as well. So it's if you need to go and look at it one more time. Okay, so last time we were talking about eventual consistency, and we said that we studied a number of consistency semantics, okay, starting from strict all the way to weak. And we said many of these semantics involve cache consistency overheads, and some applications don't want to pay the price of maintaining cache consistency. So what these applications opt for is what is called eventual consistency, which basically does not give you any consistency guarantee. All it says is if there is an update and replicas don't fail, then eventually this update is going to propagate to all of the replicas. And there is no guarantee on when it will propagate and what the delay is going to be or what order it is going to propagate. None of that is mentioned. Okay. So, as I mentioned, that there are many real-world applications that use this. Okay. DNS is an example. You make an update in the DNS system. The update is made on a particular DNS server. And eventually, the update propagates. So, every night, these DNS servers contact each other. They look for updates. And they transfer updates to one another. And this is how updates propagate in the system. So, it takes a while, but eventually, everyone gets this update. But no guarantees. Okay, it doesn't say in 1 hour everyone is going to have it. So nothing like that is said. Okay, and we'll talk about, so that was just a recap. So I'm going to present some client-centric consistency models and also present algorithms for eventual consistency. Okay, client-centric consistency models. So to understand this, I'm going to show again this picture that I showed last time. Okay, so here is a distributed data store. Okay, it has number of disks. They are geographically separated. Here is a network that separates these disks. Okay, and they replicate the same data on multiple disks. So thus far, what we have said is there are independent processes that are reading and writing to these set of disks. Okay, and our cache consistency guarantees tell us when one process writes, what does the other process see? Basically, so it's looking at relationship across processes. Where if P1 writes something here, process P1, and P2 reads something else there, what is it going to see if these two are the same data item? That is what our cache consistency semantics said. Okay. What a client-centric consistency semantics says is, let's forget about other processes. Let us just look at a single process and see what it sees from the store. Okay. So here is an example of the same laptop. Okay. So the laptop is at this location, and it has written something to this distributed data store. Maybe it makes an update to some data item on this disk. Later on, this same client moves to some other location and reads that same data item. Okay? But that read is actually seen by this disk. So question is, what does this client see? Okay, so rather than looking across processes or across client, now we focus our attention on a single client and assume that the same client can make reads or writes from arbitrary locations in the network, and in what order is it going to see reads and writes there to the same data item. And this notion is referred to as client-centric consistency. Okay? So consistency from the perspective of a single client. That's basically what we are looking at. So here is the formal definition. So there's a set of read operations by a single process at two different local copies of the same data store. And what do you see? Okay, so here are four semantics one could provide. Monotonic reads. Okay, what monotonic reads say is that subsequent reads on a data item will always either retrieve the same data item or a newer data item. Okay, so to understand all of this, let's assume that a data item, in this case, let's say is a file. The file has a version number. Okay, every time you update the file, its version number is incremented. Okay, so what monotonic read says is that if the same client reads the file multiple times, regardless of where it is reading it, it will always get the same version or a newer version. It will never get an older version once it reads. Once you read version I, any subsequent reads will give you version J that's greater than or equal to I. So you'll never see any older data once you read this. Okay. This is referred to as monotonic reads. In other words, read versions are monotonically increasing. Is that clear? Yes, no? Okay, yes. Okay. So monotonic writes is somewhat similar. It says that if you write to a data store, okay, this write has to be propagated to all replicas before successive writes by the same process. Okay, this is similar to FIFO consistency, but now only from the perspective of the same process. Okay, writes from the same process are processed in order. Okay, just in the previous case, reads were processed in order, in monotonic order. Here, writes are processed in monotonic order. Okay, so same concept, but now applied to write rather than reads. Okay. Read your writes now mix reads and writes. So it says that read x always returns the value written by write x by that process. Okay, so if you write and then subsequently read, you will at least get what that write sent into the store. Okay, so that's read your writes. Now, one way to understand this is to think about a web, right? So suppose you have a web page that you update. Okay, you update it on a file system, then you open up a browser on that machine and you read the same page. Okay? This says that if you update that page, when you read it from that client, you are going to at least see that version. Okay? Now, a violation of this is if the web server actually cached a copy of your web page in memory. Okay? So you updated the file on disk, but it may still be caching the old version. If you open a browser and read it, you may get an older version of the page. That violates reads your writes. Okay, just to give you a counter example of when you don't have read your writes. Okay, you write, but then when you read, you don't read what you wrote, you read something older. Okay. Writes follow reads is yet another semantics. It says the write followed by following a read will take place on the same or more recent version of writes. Okay, so here you first do the read and then you do the write. In this case, you first do the write and then you do the read. Okay, everything increases monotonically. You always get that or newer version. And we are only looking at one client. What other clients see is not material to us. Okay, how writes from one client propagate to another client is not guaranteed by these schemes. Okay, all this is saying is from the perspective of a single client or a single process, you need to provide some guarantees. Okay, is this clear? Okay. So now we are going to, having talked about a whole slew of semantics, we'll talk about protocols or algorithms that implement them. Okay, I'll start actually last in first of our order. So we'll start with epidemic protocols, and then we'll go and look at several others that we have talked about, see how to implement them. Okay, so epidemic protocols implement eventual consistency. Okay, so we just talked about eventual consistency. There are no guarantees, but we even want to guarantee, the only thing the protocol says is that eventually all updates will propagate. Okay, so how do you ensure this? So this algorithm is basically a randomized algorithm. Okay, so we'll use randomized algorithm to implement eventual consistency. So there was a system called Bayou that was proposed from Xerox PAR. This was, I think, about 10-15 years ago, that introduced the notion of eventual consistency and then showed how to implement it. So the protocol that we are going to talk about, called epidemic protocol, actually comes from that paper. There has been several other pieces of work that have actually come out since then. Okay? So Bayou assumes weakly connected replicas, okay, as in mobile laptops that communicate with one another. And it's assumed that these replicas have weak connectivity. The reason they relax the consistency model all the way down to eventual consistency is that they assume that the client is not always connected to the network. Okay? So here they were not worried about the overheads of consistency maintenance. If the client is not connected to the network, there's nothing you can do to propagate an update. Okay, if the client is disconnected, you cannot propagate an update to the client. So the only model that works in what is called transient connectivity world is eventual consistency. At some point later, the client is going to communicate and synchronize. Okay? That's the model. If you think about laptops and so on, you are already used to this model, right? You may actually take some file from your server, cache it on your laptop, okay, make some modification, later on connect, and these changes go back. And vice versa, you may have made some, you may have taken a cached copy, but the version on the server has changed. So next time you connect, you get the new version. Okay, so same idea holds even in that model. Okay, now the reason this algorithm is called epidemic protocol is it is based on the theory of epidemics, or how infectious diseases spread. Okay, this is basically using what is called pairwise exchange. So how do diseases spread? So if you are sick, you meet someone you shouldn't have met really, and you pass on your germs, and that person falls sick, and that person then spreads it on to someone else, and this is how diseases spread. Same thing is going to happen in this case. Okay. Servers try to infect other replicas. Okay, so if you have an update, that's something you want to infect others and spread as quickly as you can to guarantee eventual consistency. Okay. So you do pairwise exchange. So a server can pick another server at random and contact that server saying, do you have some updates to give to me? Or if you have some update, you can then transmit. So you will do pairwise exchange. So here is some information you don't have, and here is some information I have that you don't. So you exchange this. And then you pick another server at random and you continue. Okay? So if you just use this simple randomized protocol, eventually everyone is going to get all of your updates. That's the basic idea. Okay? So to understand this a little better, let's look at some terminology. There's something called an infective store. This is a store that is infected, meaning that it has some new data. It wants to spread as quickly as possible. Okay? And there's something called a susceptible store. This is a store or a disk that does not have the data item and it wants to get infected. Okay? So the idea is infective stores spread the infection or the updates to susceptible stores, and you want to do it as quickly as possible. Yeah, so there are many algorithms to do this. So the algorithm that I just mentioned very briefly is called anti-entropy. Okay? Simplest possible algorithm. Server P picks a server Q at random. So there are N servers in the system or N disks. Okay? So one disk at random points in time decides it's going to contact some other disks also picked randomly. And they contact and they will exchange updates. So there are three possibilities. You push updates, so P can push any new data items to Q, but not the other way around. Or pull, which is that P contacts Q and says, do you have something new for me? So this is pull. Or you do both push and pull, which is updates flow in both directions when two servers come in contact. Okay? So this is very simply anti-entropy. And the claim here, now any of this, either the push, pull, or push and pull, will all give you eventual consistency. Okay? Because over long periods of time, you pick servers at random, and any update in the system will keep spreading, and eventually everyone will have it. Okay? But the claim here is if you use a pure push-based approach, okay, this is not going to help you push the update out into everyone quickly. This is doing peer-to-peer exchange, as you will see, because that's what essentially what is. When you pick some other server at random, you pick a different peer and say, do you have something, or here is something you don't have. Okay. So the question is, if you just use pushed, why would it not help you spread the infection quickly? Not quickly, but to everyone.
Chances that you'll find somebody who needs, as time passes, chances that you'll find somebody who needs the update gets less.
Right. So the basic idea is, so suppose that you are the server that has an infection to spread. You are the first server in the system that has this infection. Okay? You contact some other server at random. It's very likely it's going to be susceptible, not infected, because you are the only one. Okay? So initially, in the initial phase, you will spread your infection quickly, because everyone you come in contact with doesn't have this update and you just push it out. Okay? But after some period of time, when some fraction of the servers have already gotten infected, since you are using a randomized algorithm, as more and more servers get infected, the fraction of the servers that have not gotten this update becomes smaller and smaller. And since you are picking servers at random, the probability that you will pick any of those is 1 over n, and as the number of these servers is small, so if you just pick another server, you will see it already has the update, so you don't do anything. So these small servers, number of servers that haven't got infected, will stay that way for long periods of time. But if you use both push and pull, this works well. Because since everyone is either trying to push or pull, those servers that haven't got infected will contact some other servers at random and try to pull the update. Okay, and as large number of servers get infected, the chances that they will contact the infected server is high. So they will quickly get the update. So if you use push and pull, the probability of spreading the update quickly is much higher than if you used either pull or push alone. Yes, for sure.
How do you know when to stop pushing? I mean, only when you need to know when everyone has got the data.
Right. So how do you know when to stop pushing? So the assumption here is that updates don't stop. Yeah, there are different data items getting updated all the time. So it's not that you just have one data item that you push and everyone stops. So you will keep contacting servers at random, and some other updates would have appeared in the system and you push them around and so on. Okay, so that's the way the system works. Any questions here?
So this system was built to handle transient connectivity, right?
Yes.
So is this ensured to work even when some of the nodes may come up and down?
Yes.
Arbitrarily?
Yeah. So the same system works in any model where connectivity is weak. Okay, nodes are assumed, so there is basically a network. Okay. There are some number of nodes that are participating, or these could be disks, and it's assumed that at any given time any arbitrary fraction of these nodes are down. Okay, so nodes come up, they will pick a server. If that server is down, there's nothing to do. You pick another server until you find one that is up at the same time, you try to exchange something. Okay, this is one way to do it. Okay, there are many models. So the other model is where there are some servers that are always connected and some that are have transient connectivity. In this case, the probability of spreading updates is much higher. So you will have a core set which may be connected all the time and some others that are not. In this case, you will always find someone to connect, because in the other case, all of them may be disconnected. So you may not have anyone to exchange information with. So if you have some subset of connected and some subset of disconnected, the probability of all of this working is much higher. In fact, BIO, although it works in cases where everyone has transient connectivity, it was primarily targeting this model where some servers are always on and others are not. These are laptops that come and go, and these are the actual file servers in the system. Okay, so laptops come and then you may have modified some files, you send them over, some others may have modified files on the server that you are interested in. So you do this pairwise exchange and then you get disconnected and then you come get connected again and so on. Okay, so that's how these things work. Any questions here? Okay. So there is another variant of this. So these are all doing the same thing. So the next one is called rumor mongering, also called gossiping. So this is another class of epidemic protocols which are called gossip based protocols. So this has randomized backoff. This was the question that was basically pointed out, saying when do you stop. Okay, in the previous case you don't stop, you just continue doing this forever, but here for a particular data item you can stop. Okay, So upon receiving an update, P tries to push this to Q. Okay? If Q has already received the update, then you toss a coin saying, should I continue or should I stop? Okay? So you toss a coin with probability 1 over K. So if the coin says heads, you stop. If it says tails, you continue. And depending on what K is, you can tweak the probability with which you will back off or continue spreading this infection. Okay? The reason this is called gossiping is this is how gossip works. So if you have some item of gossip, okay, you call your friends and you try to relay that. But as soon as you figure out that maybe everyone knows this, you stop spreading it. You say, okay, it's now common news, so there's no point me trying to tell everyone that something has happened. Okay? Same thing works here. So this is, so there's a randomized back-off process that is part of this algorithm. Okay? Same pairwise exchange, but with the back-off added into it. Okay? So you continue spreading so long as the item is hot, but if it's cold, if this is cold gossip, then you stop. That's the basic idea. Okay, now, since these are all randomized algorithm, there's always some small non-zero probability that some server is never going to receive an update. Okay, because all servers that got infected just backed off. Okay. Hot is something that you just started spreading and very few have received. Cold gossip is like gossip, right? Or rumor, you're spreading rumors. Okay, if everyone has received it, you'd say this is cold news or no longer worth transmitting to everyone. Right, so that's what this does, right? So basically this decides if you contact a server, it doesn't have that data item, you assume it's hot and you continue. Okay, once you contact someone and they have it, you say now it is cold, but should I stop or not? Is this the only one who has it? But there may be others who don't. So you will toss a coin here. Okay, and so with that probability you will stop, and with probability 1 minus 1 over k you will continue. Okay, so every time you find someone who has it, you toss a coin. Eventually you will stop. Okay, so there is some non-zero probability that everyone who is infected has backed off because of this randomized case without spreading it to some small number. And this is an equation that tells you for whatever some value of k, there will be s servers that will remain susceptible, never receive the update in this scheme. Okay, and you can tweak k to decide this decays exponentially, as you will see. So there will be some small non-zero servers that always have never received the update. Yes, your question.
The scenario that when updates are always coming, like in the anti-entropy case, does rumor mongering perform better than anti-entropy, like in terms of like less updates?
So rumor mongering never stops spreading update. But rumor mongering is not specific to a single data item. This is pairwise exchange, right? So this is only for this data item you stop, but for other data items you may still contact. Here you don't even distinguish. You just contact a server saying, here are the set of data items I have. Here is the set of data items you have. Give me what I don't have and take what you don't have. That's it. So you don't worry about is this spread or not. Here you do it on a per data item basis. Yeah, so you may stop spreading rumor 1, but there may be rumor k that is still spreading in the system.
What does this give us?
It depends on what you're trying to do. If you only want to spread one data item, as was pointed out, right? So suppose that this is a software patch that you're sending out into the system, okay, peer to peer. So you're not worried about lots of things, just one data item. This helps you stop at some point. Here you'll just continue even though the patch may have spread. So there's no notion of stopping. So that's the distinction. It depends on what the application is, which one you will use in what scenario. Any questions? Why is it called anti-entropy? Because you are trying to push stuff out. So you're just trying to spread. And so that's the notion. Okay. Now, the one interesting thing in this model is that removing data items or deleting stuff in the system is hard to do. Okay? So what happens, let's say, so suppose server deletes a file. Okay, so let's say data items that you're spreading are file. So if the file is just deleted, meaning that you just do an RM and you just take the file out, it just disappears from your system. Okay? Now you contact, suppose you are doing anti-entropy, you contact another server and that server still has that file. Okay, so it will assume that you don't have it or you never had it and it will send it back to you. So your file has gotten that you deleted has gotten regenerated. Okay? So in other words, there is no way to distinguish between a deleted copy and no copy. Yeah, so when I contact a server, it doesn't have something. I don't know if that server had it and it has deleted it, or it never got it in the first place. Okay? So deleted items can reappear if you are not careful in a system like this. Okay? So solution is what are called death certificates, which means that if you delete an item, you still keep some record saying, I had this item and I've deleted it. It's not as if you just do an RM on the file and it is gone. There's no trace of it. You may delete the file, but you may keep a list of deleted files. Okay, that's a death certificate saying this thing item is dead. So now when you exchange, you know that I had it and I deleted it because I have some record that I had some of that file and it's gone. It's not as if I didn't have it. So you can prevent objects from reappearing, deleted objects. So that's the way you deal with this. Okay. Now eventually you have to clean up that death certificate itself. Okay, because if you delete the death certificate and there is still one copy somewhere, you may regenerate. So you have to, the problem of when to delete that death certificate is a side issue which we will not talk about. But you do need to clean it up at some point in time. Okay. Any questions here?
Why do we need to clean up the death certificate?
The list of death certificates can grow unbounded, right, over long periods of time. So it's a log basically, a log of deleted items. So question is, when do you delete it? Entries from the log. Okay, so having talked about epidemic protocols, so next thing we are going to do is look at some generic primary based and replicated RED protocol that can be used to implement a whole host of those semantics that we talked about last time. Okay? And I'm not going to show how to implement every single one. We'll just see a couple of one by looking at some examples. Okay? So there are two classes here. One is primary based, or there's some coordinator. In another one, there is no coordinator. Okay? In the coordinator case, what happens is all the writes flow to the coordinator, and the coordinator then pushes them out to the replicas. So there's one central point that knows what writes are coming out and when they are sent out. Okay? And there is no coordinator. Everyone has to participate and figure out which writes need to go where. Okay? So that's the two classes of protocols. Okay, so we'll talk about some primary based, and then we'll look at some replicated writes. Okay, so here is our model. Okay. So here, this is the normal client-server model. So we'll assume that this is the primary server. Okay. Think of it as an NFS server. So this is where all the files are. In these cases, let's assume these are two NFS clients. Okay. So here, there is really no data at these two replicas. There's just clients sending writes, and these clients' writes just propagate to the main server. Okay. So without any replication, this is how the world looks like. Okay, so client, the first client sends a write to that machine, that write, so that's W1, that write goes to the main server. Okay? And the main server sends an acknowledgement saying, okay, your write has been committed to disk. Okay? At this point, client 1 is reading, and then that read actually sent to the server, and the server responds with that data item. Very simple. This is how file servers work. Right? You send a request to the file server, you get back a response. It could be a read or a write. Okay? So no replication yet. Okay? So here is now a replicated server that can replicate all of the data items here there. Okay? To make it more general, let's assume that this is the primary and all these three become replica. There is no reason not to cache stuff here. Okay? So we have one primary and three secondaries. So how does the protocol work? Very simple extension of what we already talked about. Okay? Write hits the local secondary. Okay? Local secondary forwards it to the primary, that's W2. Okay? So now the primary has received this write. Okay, if you want to do something like any notion of strong consistency, you will immediately broadcast this out. Okay, so that's W3. So this primary says this data item has been updated. Let me update, send this, propagate this update to all replicas. So here is W3 going out to this replica, that replica, and that replica. And all of them then send back acknowledgements, which is W4. So this replica is acknowledged, this replica has acknowledged it, and so has this. Okay? Once everyone acknowledges it, you know that this write has gone out. Okay? At that point, you can send back an acknowledgement saying everything is done. Okay? So this is the very simple model that you could use where everything flows into one central location and then it goes back out. Okay? Yes, your question there. Yeah, that's a good point. I was going to say here, in this picture, the acknowledgement has actually come from the secondary. Okay? In the, if you really wanted even stricter semantics, you would want that acknowledgement to actually first come from here and then go back here. Okay? That's absolutely right. Okay, the reason it has actually sent it out is it sent seen this W3, so it assumes that the secondary has sent out, but it doesn't wait for the acknowledgement. That's the difference. But that, so in this case, so this simple protocol that I just mentioned implements sequential consistency that we looked at the very beginning. It's not strict, but it is sequential. Okay? But you can, depending on when these updates go out, okay, you can get different consistency semantics. Okay, so here this is just the generic idea of how these remote write protocols work. Now the reason they are called remote writes is although the write hits the local thing, all the writes have to be sent to some remote location and they have to be acknowledged. Okay, that is the reason they are called remote write protocols. Now the next subclass is what are called local write protocols. So here also you have a coordinator, but the coordinator keeps changing depending on where the write activity is in the system. And this is only done for performance reasons. Okay, so again, let's look at a case with no replication first, and then we will see how you add the replication and consistency semantic. So here is the client that is just trying to write to a file. Okay, the write hits the local server machine. Okay, now this is the real primary for that machine. Okay, so initially that write is sent here, and what this server does is says that if you are seeing the write, let me just hand over responsibility for this file to you. So it just sends the entire file over and this becomes a new primary for that file. Okay. And then subsequent writes are all local, so they don't have to be sent anywhere. Okay. Now when we talk about distributed file system and NFS version 4, we will see this concept again. Okay. Until NFS version 3, the server that you have is actually this, well, there's only one server in the system and that server has the copy of all the files. But in NFS version 4, you can temporarily lend your file to some client and that client becomes a new server and you can then take back the file at any point in time. That's exactly what this protocol does. It says if your writes are happening on your machine, just become the new primary. So all subsequent writes are local and performance improves rather than sending the write over a network. Then at later the file can keep circulating in the system. Yes. Good question. So let me just show the next picture and then we'll come back to that question. So this is the same picture with the replication in it. Okay, so what happens now is the write hits the first disk. Okay, that disk, then the W2 go. Okay, so W2 is here. So at this point, it contacts the primary and the file actually moves here. Okay. Then every write just hits the local disk, but that write update has to be still propagated. Okay? In the previous case, there were two hops. Writes came here, they were sent to the primary, and the primary sent them out. Now you have become the primary, so all writes hit the local disk, and then they go out. Okay? So it's actually still improved performance in this case. Okay? And then there is a read somewhere here. So there's the read has to actually go to the new primary. Okay? So you have to keep track of who's the primary for every file in the system. Okay, that's an overhead of this thing. Now coming back to this scenario that was just pointed out, saying what happens when there are multiple clients writing to the same file. Okay? So there could be various policies. This is a policy decision. Either you let the primary be where it is, because if there are two independent clients that are writing to the same file, you can't have two primaries. You still have to have only one. So you just let the primary stay where it is and it just degenerates to the remote write case. Okay, so whenever there are multiple writers, you degenerate to remote write. If you are the only writer in the system to this file, you can do local writes. That's the basic idea. Same thing is true in NFS. Okay, in NFS, if there are multiple clients accessing a file, the server will not delegate that file. It will keep that file there and all files, clients have to send all the writes to that server. Okay. So these are all scenarios where you have a primary. Oh, your question, yes.
Is there a reason that the acknowledgement of W3 occurs before propagating the update?
Is there an acknowledgement? So it's the same scenario. You could, in the previous case, the same question was asked, right? So you could either wait, depends on what cache consistency semantics you are providing. Either you wait to propagate the replica to the writes, wait for acknowledgements from the replica and then send it. And that acknowledgement tells you that not only has the local disk received it, but everyone else has received it. Okay? In this case, this is asynchronous replication where you just send out a write. Acknowledgement just tells you local disk has received it. It doesn't guarantee that remote disks have received it. So depending on whether you want acknowledgement to tell you the remote disks have also received it or not, you get something called either asynchronous replication or synchronous replication. In synchronous, you block until every replica receives it. So that slows you down. You are operating at the slowest disk in the system, at the speed of the slowest disk in the system. Okay? In asynchronous replication, you are operating at local disk speed. You only wait until it hits the local disk. So you know at least one disk has gotten it, but not everyone. So just different semantics. Here you are actually showing asynchronous replication. Okay. So these two protocols that we just talked about have a primary. In one case the primary was fixed, in another case the primary was floating, okay, depending on where the writes are happening. So the next scheme that we'll talk about, which are called replicated write protocols, eliminate the need for a primary. Okay, this is a fully distributed scheme. There is no single primary for server for any file. Okay? File is widely replicated in the system and there is no primary. So you have to have a distributed scheme to decide who to write, when to write and who to read from. Okay? So no primary, any replica is allowed to update and you have to still achieve some notion of consistency. Okay? So in quorum based protocols, you use voting to get agreement on which writes should succeed and when writes should fail. So the basic idea behind voting is that every write should be sent to a majority number of servers. Okay, this ensures that if you want your writes to give you the most recent file, every write needs to get to a majority. If you don't get a majority, then some other client may read from these other servers and get back an older file, which you want to prevent. Okay, so you will use voting to avoid getting an older version of the file. Okay, so what happens in this case is you have what is called a read quorum and what's called a write quorum. A read quorum tells you how many servers should I contact to read a file. Okay? And write quorum says how many servers should I contact to write a file. The basic way this scheme operates is, again, files have version numbers. Okay, so let's assume there are some number of disks and the file is replicated everywhere. Okay? And each of these maintains a version number. Okay? Every time you update the file, the version number is incremented. Okay? So the way reads work is you will contact some number of servers at random and say, I am interested in reading this file. What is the version number of this file that you have locally? So all of them will say, I have version I, and someone else may say version J. If all these version numbers match, okay, and if you have designed the quorum protocol well, then you are guaranteed that everyone has the latest version of the file. If they don't match, which means some server says it has version I of the file and some server says it has a version J of the file, then the election doesn't basically result in any particular result. So you have to retry when you contact a new set of random servers until you succeed in finding a group of servers that all agree on the version number. Okay. Now the reason this always guarantees you that the right things will happen is you put some constraints on what the size of the read quorum is and what the size of the write quorum is. In particular, if there are n servers, the write quorum always has to be a majority. Okay. Meaning whenever you write a file, you always write to n over, so some number of servers that's greater than n over 2. Okay. If there are 10 servers, you will always have to write to at least 6 or more. This ensures that a majority of the servers have received the update. Okay? And then you can pick the read quorum so that you satisfy this property. Okay? So let's look at three examples that basically tell you how this works. Okay? So here are 10 servers. Rather 12 servers. Okay? So the write quorum has been set to 10, the read quorum has been set to 3. So what this effectively says is every time you write to a file, you contact 10 of these 12 servers at random, and you write to that 10 servers. Okay, these 10 servers now get the new version of the file. And the read quorum says that you can contact any 3 servers at random, and if those 3 servers all agree on the version number, you are guaranteed that you have the latest version of the file. Okay? Now they may disagree. So here is a scenario where they disagree. So the what's shown in the dotted line is your write quorum. Those are the 10 servers. And the read client actually picked A, B, and C. Okay? So since A and B did not receive that update, they will have an older version. But C has received the update. Okay? So these will disagree and you are prevented from reading an old version of the file. So you have to retry. So you will pick three other servers at random, and maybe this time you pick IJ and K. Okay. Since they were all in that write quorum, you will actually get agreement that they will all have the same version. And if you read that version, that is indeed the right version to pick. Okay.
You pick three new servers?
The protocol is anytime you do a read or anytime you do a write, you pick those many servers in your read or write quorum at random, and you either read or write. And there has to be an agreement. In the read case, they have to agree that this is the latest version. Okay. Here is an example where it doesn't work. Okay. This, so here the write, again 12, but the write quorum has been set to 6. The read quorum has been set to 7. Okay. So the dotted line shows the servers that you have written to. Okay. Now you pick 7 servers at random in this case, and it's guaranteed you will never have agreement. You will never find 7 servers that always have the same version number. Okay, here is an example where you pick the 6 that were not updated, but since you have to pick 7, you have to pick one of these. Right? So this H is never going to agree with the other 6. Okay? Or you may pick exactly these 6, but you're forced to pick one of those that did not receive the update. So that one will not agree with this. So no matter how you pick your read quorum, you will never succeed. System is still working. It is guaranteeing you will never read outdated version of the file. Okay? But it is also guaranteeing you will never read anything. Okay? So it doesn't guarantee bad results, but it is not giving any good results either. Okay? And the simple reason for this is that you violated the scheme where the write quorum had to be greater than majority. You set it to exactly half. Okay? But this has to be greater than half. This is why you are not able to get agreement. Okay. So here the write quorum was 10, which is greater than 6. But here you set it to 6. Okay, so but it still works. It prevents you from doing bad things. It's just that good things don't happen here. Yes, there was a question somewhere. Okay. Now here is the last scenario where you will read from exactly one server, but you are always guaranteed to get that file no matter which server you pick. Okay. In other words, you set the read quorum to 1. So you want to just contact one server at random, and you want to be guaranteed that that server always has the most recent file. The only way to do this is to set the write quorum to the whole set. Okay. Only if you transmit your update to all of the servers can you then contact only one of that lot and be guaranteed. Otherwise, this won't work. Okay. Again, you see that all of this is possible if because they all satisfy this equation. In this case, NW set to the whole set. So NR plus NW has to be greater than this, so NR has been set to 1. So this, so long as these two equations are satisfied, you will always get correct results. So both this scenario satisfy that result. Okay? This one does not, which is why you are having problems. Okay, so these are voting based schemes. Okay, so you assume that there are some number of replicas, you use voting to retrieve the most recent version of the file. And the voting tells you who has the most recent version, or whether if they have a conflict, then you keep running this election until somebody agrees.
In the previous slide, you said contact at least n by 2 bar plus 1
service. This is a simpler scenario of this, okay, the special case. This is the general case. Okay, this is a special case where you always contact n by 2 plus 1, and then the read one has to again contact majority. Okay, any questions here? Is this clear? Okay. All right, so there are some other issues that I will talk about briefly, and the reason I'm going to only talk about briefly is we will come back to this in the context of the web and understand at a much deeper level how these things work. Okay, so but I just want since this is relevant to this discussion on replication, I just wanted to mention this. Okay. These are orthogonal issues that we haven't talked about. So we did cache consistency semantics. We looked at some protocols that allow you to implement these semantics. And here are some orthogonal issues that come about in replication and caching. The first one is server placement, replica placement. Okay, so this says if your application is geographically distributed, where should you put these replicas? Okay, so should you put them all in one site, in some dark room somewhere? Should you distribute them across the internet? Typically, if your access patterns are skewed, meaning that there are some requests, some geographical locations where there are more requests than others, this says that put your replicas closer to where the clients are. This allows clients to get better performance. Okay, so if you have, let's say, a newspaper site and it's, let's say, it's the New York Times. Okay, the New York Times is probably a bad example. It's popular in more than one location, but let's say it's the Daily Hampshire Gazette, okay, local Amherst newspaper. Okay, you would rather want to put replicas here rather than putting a replica on the West Coast, because that doesn't make sense. You're more likely to have users here than somewhere else because the content there is of only of local interest. Right? So trying to understand where your requests are coming from or where your clients are is important for doing good server placement. And when we talk about content distribution networks, we will come back to this problem and see where to put these replicas and so on. Okay. The second one is, are your replicas permanent or temporary? Okay. If your replicas are permanent, then this says that you have to know your workload demands ahead of time, saying in the worst case, I'm going to get a request rate of N, and then you say for satisfying that peak workload, I need 6 replicas, okay, and then I provision for 6. Okay. In the temporary case, you are actually varying the number of replicas based on demand. Okay. As demand goes up, you add more replicas to the pool. As demand goes down, you take the replicas away. Okay. So you are now trying to match the replicas or the system capacity to workload demand. Okay. So you do either on-demand replication or static replication. Okay. And then the last dimension is, who initiates the replication? Is this server initiated or is this client initiated? Caching is a good example of client initiated replication. Okay? And some of these other techniques are good examples of server initiated replication. So what happens in caching is, if you take web caching as a good example, you have a server somewhere. This is the main web server. You have a proxy. Okay? Then you have a browser. So instead of a client server system, you have a client proxy server system in this case. Okay? So this is your browser or the client. So client always sends request to the proxy. Okay? Proxy has a cache. If that request is cached, you get a cache hit and the response is immediately sent back. Okay? The request is a cache miss, which means it is not cached. The proxy is going to send another request to the server. Fetch that data item, put it in the cache, and then send back a response. Okay? So this is what happens in the case of the web, where there are web proxies sitting on the edges of the network. Your browsers can contact web proxies. They could be transparent or they could be known to your browser. And then the proxy acts as an intermediary between the server and the client. If things are cached, you get the responses back immediately. Okay? Now here, this is an example of client-initiated replication, because there was a web page here. Because the client wanted it, it got cached here and a replica got created. Okay, this was purely on demand because of a request that was triggered by the client. Okay. This is called client-initiated replication. In server-initiated replication, the server can do some analysis to see which objects are popular and proactively replicate them. Okay. So there are some things you know that are going to be popular. So if, let's say, you run the CNN website, okay, you know that the main page of CNN, that's the first thing that most people are going to go to. Okay. So that is always, it's a no-brainer to replicate it. Okay, whenever it changes, you replicate it. But if you are deep down in the CNN hierarchy somewhere, let's say you are looking at sports page for UMass basketball, okay, there only some subset of users are going to be interested in this, not everyone. Okay, so you may or may not replicate it depending on demand. Okay, so the server has to decide which objects are popular, which ones are not, and take the popular objects and replicate them proactively. Okay. In client-initiated, this adjusts based on demand. Whatever the clients want, get replicated. Whatever they don't want, doesn't get replicated. That's automatic. Okay. Again, when we come back to the web, we'll look at these issues. Okay. Who replicates and when things get replicated. Okay. So that's coming in Chapter 12, and where we'll also look at content distribution networks. Okay. So these are just to give a little more background on what a CDN is. So it's over here. content distribution network is simply a geographically distributed network of proxy caches. Okay? So if there are machines that are deployed everywhere in your network, and each of them has a cache. Okay? And they all coordinate with each other to cache some server content. So whenever a client wants, so suppose that this is the CNN server, again to take the same example, and some of this content is cached on all of these proxies. Okay, but these proxies may have different subsets of that content, not the same thing everywhere. So whenever a browser wants a certain page, okay, what the CDN will do is figure out which of these proxies actually have cached that page. And then subsequently, if there are some subset of them that have it, let's say P1 and P2 has the page that the browser wants, it will also see where is the browser located and which of these proxies are closest to that browser, and your request gets serviced by the nearest proxy that has cached that page for you. This ensures that you get caching benefits, okay? Even though you may have to go to one of these, but not necessarily the nearest one. But whenever you have the page cached, you go to the nearest one and get good performance. So this is what content distribution networks do. And we will again come back to all of these issues when we do chapter 12. Okay? So there are a whole bunch of them saying whether data is pushed or pulled, is a server initiated versus client initiated, the stateful or stateless, which says do these proxies and servers keep state of who is caching what, who to send invalidations, if the page changes on the server, should the caches be invalidated? Should you keep state of that or not? Should you send updates or invalidates? Okay, so if you have a page that has changed, okay, let's say the CNN main page is cached at some of these, if it changes, should you just send a message saying it has changed or delete the version on your cache, or should you actually send the new version of the page? Okay. So there are pros and cons and various trade-offs here, which again we defer this discussion. I just want to mention it here to provide the right context. Okay, so we'll actually come back to this later. Any questions here before I start a new topic? In CDNs or in general? So we'll look at several schemes when we do chapter 12, which are either it's the responsibility of the proxy or schemes where it's the responsibility of the server. Okay? If it is the responsibility of the server, okay, so every time a page changes, you have to broadcast either an invalidate or an update to all the proxies that have cached it. Okay? This makes the server stateful. Okay? If it's the responsibility of the proxy, the server doesn't maintain any state, the proxy can periodically contact the server saying, I have these pages, have any of them changed? Okay, and then you can figure out if it has changed or not. And then if something has changed, then you invalidate from your cache so you don't send an old version to your clients. You do things like this. Okay. Yes. Yes. In this case, the distinction between the proxies and the server is clear. Okay, proxies know what they are doing and the server knows what it has. Okay, so you basically have this distinction between a server and a proxy.
Yeah, and the server will also know the proxy.
In this case, so if you have a server initiated, you actually have to know who are the proxies. There are ways by which you don't necessarily need to do this, and that where here what happens is you may only need to know a root proxy. Okay, and then you only send updates or invalidates here, and this proxy actually sends it out. So in this case, the knowledge of where the proxies are is not at the server, but it has some other distinguished node in the content distribution network. Okay, that way there's a decoupling between what, if you run a website, you don't need to know about, let's say, 5,000 proxies that are out there in your CDN. You only need to know maybe a few root ones, and they will take care of propagating changes to everyone else. Any other questions? Okay. So that's sort of the wrap-up slide on replication and caching. So just to recap very quickly, we said the reason you need replication and caching were two. Right? You wanted better performance from replication, and you wanted high availability. So if some replicas go down, someone else also has that data item. Okay, that was the motivation for doing this. And the main problem of either caching or replicating data is that there are multiple copies. So if anyone changes, you have to ensure that everyone else also gets that update. Okay, this is cache consistency. So we looked at several semantic, we probably looked at easily between 10 to 15 various models of cache consistency semantics. They provide different levels of guarantees. We're starting from strict all the way down to eventual consistency. There's a whole spectrum of consistency guarantees. And which one you pick depends on what the application is, how tolerant it is to keeping some stale data around. Okay, so web caching, weak consistency is okay. In other cases, it may not be. Okay, and then depending on which one you pick, there may be implementation overheads. Okay, so you have to consider the overheads of implementing a certain scheme and weigh that against what the application wants and make the right choice. Okay, so there's a whole spectrum of applications that just pick different ones depending on their needs. Okay, so now in subsequent classes, we'll look at only the web scenario and see how to do it in the context of web. But do keep in mind that this notion of replication goes much beyond web server. Okay, it's used widely in databases and lots of other applications. Okay, so with that, what we'll do is move on to the next topic. And I'm going to just do a quick overview today. Okay, and then we'll actually come back to this next time. So this topic is on fault tolerance. I believe this is chapter 7. Okay. So let me do the initial motivation, and that's where we will stop for the day. Okay. So again, we start with single machine systems. Okay, if your entire application runs on one machine, there's no replication, then the failure of the machine basically says application goes down. Okay, so it's always either application is working when it's in operational state, or if there's a crash, then the application goes down, okay, and becomes unavailable. So fault tolerance is not interesting in single machine systems. Okay. When you have a distributed system, you have multiple nodes. Okay. So in this case, failure of some node need not bring down the whole application. If some other nodes are willing to accept responsibility for what the failed nodes were doing, their application can continue to function, but in a degraded mode. Okay. So partial failures are possible, but the application as a whole can continue to operate. Okay. So the question is, can we recover automatically from partial failure? And what's the probability that you will actually recover from it? And so to understand some of these questions, you have to understand that as the amount of replication, or rather the number of nodes in your system, continues to grow, some nodes failing becomes the common case. Okay, and this is basically shown by this equation, which is the probability of a failure. Okay, is the probability that any one component in the system fails, which is the probability of 1 minus no failure. Okay, and this probability starts approaching 1 as the number of components starts going to infinity. Okay, this should be clear, because the probability of a failure is probability any one component fails is 1 minus no failures is 1, or p to the power n, where p is the probability of a single component failure. Okay. As n goes to infinity, p to the n goes to 0, so this probability is going to approach 1. Okay, so if you have massive systems, there's always going to be some failures in the system. Okay, so if you take Google or Amazon or any of these very large systems, some fraction of the nodes are always dead. Okay, because there are so many components, or something or the other is going to fail. Yet you want the service to continue to operate. You don't want failure of some number of nodes to take down your whole system. So as the number of components grows to very large sizes, you have to build fault tolerance into a system. Okay, so you start with single machine system, only one node. Here machine goes down, the system stops functioning. You go to some number of nodes. Okay, so you go from 1 to n, where n is small. You can tolerate failures, meaning you can have some partial failures, but your system continues to work. Okay? But as you go, as n becomes very large, you have to build for failures, okay? Because that's going to be the common case in your system. So if you don't do that, then your system is going to go down. Okay? So this is, as a result, since we are interested in distributed systems, these are the two scenarios we want, the distributed case and the very large case. So it's clear that this is an important topic. Okay? Now, to give some historical background on fault tolerance, it is clear that computing systems traditionally have not been built with reliability in mind, at least as a first-class concern. Okay? So we probably all have operating system crashes. system goes down. We had one when I was giving a lecture some time back, that you have to reboot the machine, buggy software, hardware fails, and we live with it. Okay, this is the reason is we have been, we have grown accustomed to machines failing. But this is not how all systems are designed. Right? So basically, if you look at your television or car or something, right? So let's say television, and you turn it on, you expect it to come on. Okay, there's no question of rebooting your television because it failed or something like that. So it's not built for that. Okay, if it fails, then you throw it out, you buy a new one. Okay? But that's not the way you actually design computer system. You assume that there will always be bugs, and rebooting is a necessary evil of life. So this is okay so long as people are tech savvy. So you understand that machines are going to be failing and you have to reboot and so on. But as the internet has made computing widespread and pervasive, this is not what other people are used to. Okay? They expect reliable system. They don't expect that every day you have to reboot your system because the computing systems are designed differently from all other systems. This is not what people who are not computer users are used to. They expect that if you paid $1,000 for your machine, it better work, right? So there is a need to actually think carefully about reliability and dependability. Right? Now, it may be one thing to say this for desktops and laptops, which is still okay, but when you actually build services that you offer to other users, it becomes even more critical. So example being online banking, right? Or Amazon.com, okay? Here, failures can actually cause financial losses, right? If a stock trading site goes down, okay, there will be financial losses that users of that trade will going to face because they could not trade and they made some losses, as well as the broker itself because they are losing money, right? So Amazon goes down, orders stop coming. Okay, there is bad news and people go to some other site. They say this site is not reliable. So when you build these internet services that people depend on and use all the time, you are actually, money is on the line, right? People are going to face losses if you don't build reliable systems. So this is one key reason why when you build these very large distributed systems, this has to be a fundamental principle, not just an afterthought. Okay? So is security, which we will not talk about right now, but security is another of those things that you brush under the rug and then you sort of try to bolt it on later. Okay? But these have to be important design principles to begin with. Okay? So here are some terminology now before we actually talk about any real concept. So the point is we want to build dependable system, right? So there are very many ways by which you can specify requirements. Okay? So the one way to do it is what are called 5 nines of reliability. This says that the system is 99. So 5 nines is 99.999% reliable. Okay? So there are many computing systems that want that reliability. So stock exchanges is one example. Okay? So they are built with this level of reliability. So what this says is that the downtime, the probability that your system is down is 0.0001. Okay? That boils to 5 nines effectively means few minutes of downtime a year. Okay, so that's the amount of downtime you're willing to tolerate. So it may be that there may be software upgrades or patches coming out. You can't take the system down. You have to build a system as in individual machines can come down. The system as a whole cannot come down. It has to operate with very high reliability guarantees. Okay. Now, so there are systems that are built with that level of reliability, but not all systems, as we probably know. Our laptops and desktop don't give us anything close to this. Okay. So here are some other things to keep in mind. So reliability, when I say reliability, just a system should run continuously without failure. Okay, that's what it means. Okay. Safety says that temporary failure should not cause catastrophic failures, meaning some components can come down, but there's enough redundancy in the system so the system as a whole will run. Okay? So when you have things like nuclear reactors or computing systems that are built to control a plane, they have safety properties built in, meaning there's enough redundancy that if some components fail or go down, there isn't a catastrophic failure. Okay? If many components fail, there may still be a catastrophic failure, but that's not what I mean. Small number of component failures shouldn't cause catastrophic failure. And maintainability just says a failed system should be easy to repair. Okay, there should be something in there to tell you why it failed and how it failed and what needs to be done to fix it. Okay. So we'll start with some very basic concepts. Okay. And then next time I'm going to talk about more details here. So here are some types of faults that could occur in a system. Transient faults, an intermittent fault, and a permanent fault. A transient fault just says there's some fault that appeared and then it went away, it doesn't come back. Okay? There's a bit that got flipped in memory of your machine for whatever reason, and then it just fixed itself and it doesn't appear anymore. Intermittent faults are faults that come and go. Okay? There is something for some component is faulty, but it works sometimes and it doesn't work some other time. Okay? This is like the car that you take to a mechanic. Right? So problem disappears when you go there. Then you come back and problem reappears. So this is the kind of problems that you have intermittent fault. Permanent fault, this component actually failed. It is not up, so you need to replace it. Okay, so these are some things to keep in mind as basic background. Okay, here are the failure models that we will worry about also. Okay, there are different types of failures. Not all failures are the same. Okay, crash failure says server basically stops working, but until it failed, it was working fine. Okay, either there was a software crash or a disk crash, some component failed and then it stopped working, but until then it was fine. Okay. Omission failure says a server failed to respond to incoming requests. Okay, there are two types of omission failure depending on whether it failed to send a receipt or it failed on the send. Okay, either failed to send a message or receive the messages. Okay. Timing failure is more interesting. Okay, so here the server is operating. Okay, the service is operating, but it is very slow and it's violating some timeliness constraints. Okay? This is also a failure. Okay? In some cases, this failure impacts more things than stream data. Basically, the service is built to guarantee certain properties like performance. So you build a service that guarantees 500 millisecond response time. Okay? If you go to many online brokerage firms, so if you actually look at their contract, some of them guarantee times on trades. Okay, it says if you place a trade, you have 1 second. So here is the simplest possible way. This is sort of the building block that we will use to implement some redundancy model. Okay, so this is actually a circuit. Okay, so this is a circuit with three elements, A, B, and C. Okay, A, so here is a one-bit circuit. So it's a one-bit signal coming in. It does some computation. It puts out a 0 or a 1. Okay, that goes to the next stage of the circuit. It does something. It computes a function, again puts out a 0, 1, or 1. And that goes to C, it does the same thing. Okay? There's no redundancy there. So if either A, B, or C fail, circuit as a whole fails. Okay? Here is a version of the circuit with redundancy built in. Okay, so here, there are three versions of A. Okay, the three versions of B, three versions of C. Okay, so A1, A2, and A3 do the same thing. Okay? So the signal is now fed to all three components. Each of them produces a result. And there's a voter. The voter basically takes the output of all three and then it computes a result. And the result is the majority of this. Okay, so it's guaranteed that if only one of them is going to fail, the other two are going to agree. So either all of them agree or only two of them agree. So that's the output that you put out. And that goes to the next stage and there's a voter and so on. Okay. So this very simple idea of how do you build a redundant circuit is also the same principle that we will use to build redundant services. Okay, so you could actually think of this now rather than a circuit, think of it as a multi-tier application. When we talked about this web tier application, you had a web server, Java server, and a database backend. Right? So if you just have one of each, then if any one goes down, service goes down. But you could actually now do the same thing. You replicate each of them, right? Have the result, you compare the result, and then you propagate that to the next. So this could be three copies of the web server running on three machines. This is your load distributor that also has a voting scheme in there. This is three copies of your Java server, three copies of the database server. Same principle can be used to also build redundant services. And in this case, this particular example, although it looks very simple, can address Byzantine faults, as we'll come back to later. Meaning any of these can start behaving arbitrarily and start producing garbage. The system as a whole, or just fail. System as a whole continues to work. And you can tolerate one fault per stage in this system. At any of these, you can have one fault. The water, there can be one of these can fail, one of these, or one. System will still work. Okay, so this is a one fault tolerant system. Yeah. And we'll use this to build other systems in subsequent classes. So let's stop there, but don't go away. I have several things to hand out.